Hello, my friends. I'm Bill McLaughlin. Welcome to St. Paul Sunday.
St. Paul Sunday is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and made possible by a major grant from the Minnesota-based General Mills Foundation, supporting excellence in education, human services, and the arts. Additional funding has been provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and by this Public Radio International station. Join us today with our guest, pianist Garrick Olson.
Well, I've got a great friend with me in the studio today. It's pianist Garrick Olson, whom I've known and worked with for a long time in many places. You've been on this show in a number of different ensembles. And one of the things I've always loved about your programming, Garrick, is that it requires a little detective work, if you will, on the part of the listener, because there always are these secret threads that hold the pieces together that are not immediately apparent. It looks like that's true in today's program.
That is certainly the case between two of the pieces today, which have a very not-so-thin thread holding them together, which we'll talk about. And maybe we can find some other connective tissue also.
We're going to have music of Handel, then Beethoven and Schubert, and there is a relation there, which Garrick will tell us as we get there. And then a composer who is very dear to your heart, I suppose, since you won the Chopin competition in Warsaw back in, was that 1970?
1970.
And you've recently been going all over the country, all over the world, really playing Chopin. And I've read, is this true, you've played every blessed note that Chopin wrote for the piano in public recently?
Well, just about. Not quite every blessed note in public, but virtually all of them. And I am also recording every blessed note that I can find.
Yeah, and we will have Chopin at the end of the program, but you're starting about as far away as it can go, as I can see it in the music of Handel. And it's an F major suite. Now, the keyboard music that Handel wrote comes, I think, relatively early on in his life, from what I've read.
I believe so, although these suites, if I'm not mistaken, are date from 1720, which is, I guess, maybe middle, but
yeah.
I'm not much of a Handel scholar.
Yeah, they frequently are either Italian in style, or some of them are French, because they follow the French dance suite, but this particular one you're going to play, the F major, does not. It is very Italian, slow, fast. Tell us what the movements are.
The first movement is an ecstatic aria of incomparable, radiant beauty, I mean, heavenly beauty, and a sort of endless line that spins on and invents itself. The second movement is a very lively allegro, and very kind of crisp and almost perpetual motion, kind of, you know, frisky. The third movement is kind of a recitative, very slow and beautiful harmonically and melodically. And the fourth movement is a fugue, a rather rigorous fugue.
Okay, those of you at home who are members of the Counterpoint Police can get out your notebooks and see how close he sticks. Here are four movements now of the suite in F major. This is music of Friedrich Handel, played by Garrick Olson. the greatest composer who ever lived. I would bow my head and kneel at his grave. These are the words of Ludwig van Beethoven in 1824, just 3 years before Beethoven died. And hearing you play that, Gary, I can feel that reason for Beethoven's admiration. This was music of George Frederick Handel, the suite in F major, the second suite, played by marvelous pianist Gary Golson. And I must say, I rarely hear you move into the Baroque repertoire, but you play it with such passion, you must play it a lot.
Thank you. I hope to play at least this piece with great passion and other Baroque pieces.
It's a great thing. I wonder if you folks at home, I mean, so many of you know this sort of thing inside out, but this whole notion of fugue is rather an interesting one. It's just an imitation, like a kind of follow the leader game. We have real simple imitative processes in music, like a kind of thing where you go row, row, row your boat, and then your brother comes in and sings exactly the same thing on the same pitches. One of the things that makes the fugue interesting is that it doesn't come in on the same pitches. I wonder if you could show just...
Right, exactly. It starts always at a different part of the scale. So the first statement is... called the subject.
Of, right.
But then the second voice comes in at the end of it. This is the first voice. And they start piling up.
Yeah, and the wonderful thing about moving off the same pitch is it takes the discussion to the other fields, because you get very quickly tired of hearing the same notes sung endlessly, however charming they may be.
Exactly.
And
every voice is quite sufficient unto itself. In other words, every voice is a piece of music by itself.
Right.
And they all go together.
Yeah, which is a very vastly difficult trick to learn to do well.
Yes, all of us who have been to music school have had some amount of counterpoint class. I don't know if we've all tried to write a fugue. I suppose I tried. Boy, it's hard. In the way that in English class we all try to learn sonnets and things and discover how tricky this is to make it all work.
Right.
And then on top of that, to have a nice piece of music as well, not just to make the rules work.
Right. I'd mentioned at the beginning of this show that you seem to have very themes in your programming, and I'd mentioned further that Beethoven had the highest regard of anyone for Handel.
That's right.
And it happens now, of course, here's the next part of our theme, we're moving to the music of Beethoven.
Beethoven, yes. That was sort of an unintended but pleasant consequence. The Handel is basically with us today because I like it, and it doesn't get played much, so I thought let's place it, let's do it.
And you're going to play just one movement of a Beethoven sonata.
Right.
Relatively early one, around the time he was about 30 years old.
Exactly. The finale of the sonata opus 31, number 1 in G major.
Mm-hmm. Any reason for choosing this?
Well, now we come to the big mystery thread of this show, which is that the next piece I'm going to play after this is another finale of Schubert's penultimate sonata in A major. And what's interesting is to see how one great composer, in this case Schubert, modeled his whole movement and the shape and structure and style of the whole movement on Beethoven's earlier finale. In other words, as if he took the architectural plans and built another but rather different house following the same design.
Oh, what a nice image. Let's hear it. Well, we're going to start with a Beethoven. This is the Rondo, it's an allegretto for the sonata in G major, opus 31, number 1. Our pianist, Garrick Olson.
Thank you.
almost dissolves after that fury that he throws into. This is the finale of a Beethoven sonata movement. It's the Opus 31, number 1, G major sonata. Gary Golson, our pianist. It's astonishing, isn't it? The tune itself that Beethoven uses is rather simple. I mean,
Terribly simple, almost
exaggeratedly so. It's like a folk tune.
Naive.
Yeah. And yet he subjects it to such rigorous analysis that he really pulls it apart. Almost.
Absolutely. It has lots and lots and lots of false endings, which is something Schubert's going to do in the finale of his Big A Major Sonata too.
Yeah.
But in a totally different way. Not as manic, not as broadly humorous.
I just read, too, that he met Beethoven only once. It was about a week before Beethoven died. It was March 19th of 1827.
Wow.
Schubert went with his two closest friends, the Hüttenbrenner brothers. It sounds like a vaudeville team. And they went to visit Beethoven at Beethoven's apartment. Beethoven had just been looking at some Schubert manuscripts, some of the songs. We don't know what they said.
Ah.
And then a week later, Beethoven was dead. And a year and a half later, 31-year-old Schubert gone.
Yeah, I didn't know that they had actually met. I was laboring under the impression they didn't, and that Beethoven at some point made a comment about this, Schubert. I mean, he said something very good about him. He said, who keeps himself rather secret.
Yeah, it was certainly true. It's funny because they were living in the same city from the time that Schubert was born.
Exactly.
I think that before we get to the performance of this, I better take a moment and identify ourselves. This is Garrick Olson, with whom we've been speaking, marvelous pianist, and our program so far has included Handel and Beethoven. We're just going to get to Schubert and Chopin. I'm Bill McLaughlin, and you're tuned to St. Paul's Sunday. Now, when you say that Schubert used the Beethoven as a model, what did he do? Did he copy the notes? Or?
No, not at all. It's much more subtle, and this is a good example of how one great composer can pay tribute to another. This is also a good example of how, when I say modeling, I don't mean the tunes or the harmonies, or even the style of the piece. It's a very different piece. Let me play you the theme of the Beethoven, which is, as we said, a bit naive, almost folkishly simple. Well, that's only half of the first part of it, but just to remind you. Now, the first time Beethoven makes a variation on that, it's actually a rondo, but he varies the theme by adding things to it, not by changing the tune. The next time you hear the tune, is in the, he takes it from the right hand and puts it in the bass, quite literally. Literally, but then he puts a new accompaniment on top of it, some triplets in the right hand, which you'll hear. So it's not even a variation, it's a decoration, more or less. Now, Schubert's piece, which is also folksy and a bit naive, now, the next time you hear that, of course, the tune will be in the left hand. And guess what's going to be in the right hand? So you can see that that's really quite a direct, you know, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, I think. Another astonishing way in which he really models himself is that Beethoven does a lot of false endings. First he plays this. Then he waits and goes slower. It goes through all kinds of pauses and finally breaks out fast. Toward the end of his piece, Schubert just sort of stops everything. And goes through an entirely different chain of related searchings, like, what am I doing now?
Yeah.
Is this over? And then finally, he also just goes real fast and winds the whole thing up, but not in a manic, funny way like Beethoven does, more almost a bit desperate. But it's really, I mean, the nature of the pieces is quite entirely different, but it's sort of like, you could say that they're sort of maybe family members or something who don't agree on lots of things, but they also seem to have some genetic structure underlying them.
And there's a lot of resemblance as a result.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't wait to hear this now. This is the finale of the great last A major sonata, one of these last three sonatas that Schubert was writing in the final weeks of his life. But now we see that it is, in many ways, a direct homage to Beethoven and perhaps surpasses his master. Here's Gary Golson to play the last movement of the Schubert A major.
Thank you.
extraordinary music. It never fails to move me. This is the finale of one of the three great sonatas which Schubert wrote in the last weeks of his life. He was dying at the age of 31, and he kept pouring out music. It's like all of his life's energy went into this marvelous performance just now by Gary Golson, our pianist, who had linked this up with the Beethoven Rondo, Opus 31, number 1, saying that Schubert had modeled this particular work, and it was astonishing to hear the two works played side by side, as you have in this program.
I hope you could hear them going by. Of course, what I forgot to mention earlier is that the scale of the Schubert is at least twice as long and twice as wide and,
yeah,
and big. And of course, he takes other detours, but it's pretty clear.
Yeah. And now we have time, I think, for one more piece, and this is the composer who has been your trademark for the longest period of time since you're winning the Chopin competition back in 1970. You're kind of a national hero, from what I understand, when you go to Poland.
Well, I don't know if I go so far as to say that I'm a national hero in Poland, but I'm very well known and a very public figure there. I've been smiled at by passport officials and so on. No, I think the real secret is that after I won the prize, of course, they love all of their Chopin Prize winners, and the Chopin Prize in Poland is very big news. I was one of the foreigners. I was not only not Polish, I wasn't even Slavic by national origin in any way, shape, or form. And even though it was during the communist times, and they knew there that it was not always the easiest and certainly not the most economically profitable thing for me to do to come back, I had a profound emotional experience in Poland, because playing Chopin for a Polish audience which knows him and loves him so well, not only loves him but reveres him as part of their symbolic history, he's the greatest national hero. It nourished me in such a way that I really wanted more, and I kept going back and I kept going, getting that nourishment. So they saw a great deal of me, so maybe they just got to like me because I kept coming back so much, I don't know. Needless to say, no two Poles agree on how Chopin ought to be played, so it's always a very controversial issue.
Especially if someone comes from Juilliard School to show them.
Yeah, somebody from what was in the cultural Wild West, you know, not too long ago.
Yeah. You want to play one of the scherzos?
Right. This has nothing to do with anything else in the program, but I just thought, the nice thing about Chopin is it goes in any place, any time.
Yeah, and you've been playing all of his repertoire, and I've always loved the way you play Chopin. You're going to play the scherzo in C-sharp minor, which he wrote on the island of Mallorca.
That's right.
He was so in love with this woman who called herself George Sand, and for once, one of Chopin's loves helped him compose. She gave him some inspirations and some sense of stability.
That's right.
So this is a great piece. Let's hear it. Here's the
scherzo. This is, by the way, just not to prejudice anybody, such a truly bizarre piece. I don't know how Chopin ever managed to put all these ideas into one container which barely manages to hold them, but that's part of its brilliant tension.
Thank you.
I almost thought Gary Olson was going to leap into this Steinway, to the conclusion of this. This is music of Friedrich Chopin, the C-sharp minor, though it ends in the major just there. The C-sharp minor scherzo, opus 39. Get your breath back, big guy.
Yeah, just barely.
What an amazing piece of music. He's 29 years old when he made this, already starting to show signs of the tuberculosis that would kill him in 10 years. There's another one who had a short life, short
exactly.
And brilliant.
He was another morbid weakling, as you can hear in the music.
Oh, my God. What heroic music, this hymn tune almost that comes again and again, and it's an embellishment. One of the things I was just noticing, I've known you for a long time now, you're a big lad, you're 6'4", powerfully built.
This is true.
Have big hands, but I was just noticing your fingers are relatively rather slender, elegant, long but slender.
Oh.
I was just thinking that when I was watching you play this Chopin, that combination of power and delicacy, you can actually see its physical expression.
Well, that's interesting. I'm very blessed with that because people often comment that I have big hands, which I certainly do, but in fact, most people who are 6'4" have big hands. I have only sort of average size hands for a 6'4" person. And luckily they're not thick, because thick fingers have been the torment of some even very fine pianists.
Right.
So,
strong hands are good. This has been a marvelous program. We started with the Handel Suite. We had the Beethoven and Schubert movements. The Schubert, in this case, was based upon, as a model, the Beethoven.
Right. And perhaps, although this was not conscious, perhaps Chopin's most Beethovenian scherzo. At least in its taut, outer, powerful sections.
And now we find the final connection, because there is a thread running through almost everything that Gary Olson does when he gives a concert.
And if I may just add something, which so overwhelmed me right now as I was playing, which has been much commented upon, but when it strikes you, it strikes you, is how Chopin opened up the piano. Because, of course, first I played a piece which is actually a harpsichord piece, and then I played two movements by gentlemen who were great piano composers and wrote great piano music, and yet the sheer sound of the instrument, it sounds like it was just invented in the Chopin scherzo. It sounds like you didn't know what the piano could, you didn't hear it in Technicolor.
Mm-hmm.
I was so stunned by this this roar that was suddenly emerging.
It was terrific. It was a glorious sound. You're recording all the Chopin. You've got lots of records out. Some of
them
are hard
almost,
to find.
Chopin's almost done, believe it or not. It's taken, well, I guess 8 years so far, and we're volume 8 has been just released, which means that 10 CDs are out, two of them are doubles, and mm-hmm. I just finished the Etudes, which should come out this year, and I'm dancing through the mazurkas, and so that will probably come out next year sometime.
Some of your records are a little hard to find, and the reason I'm saying this is there's a way which public radio can be very useful in helping
I'm
you.
Glad.
It's called Public Radio Music Source. There's an 800 number, so if you want to find any of Garrick's recordings, you can give us a call at 800-75-MUSIC. And one of the nice benefits of that project is that any profits go to help support your public radio stations. So good luck with all this recording, and come again. Boy, this is such a wonderful program, Garrick.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, hope you folks will let Garrick know how much you liked it. You can email him through us. He's looking like he's going to have to buy a computer now, but we'll make sure he gets it. We'll get him what we call hard copy. Our email address, sunday@npr.org. M is in Minnesota, PR.org. And in fact, if you're one of those blessed souls that prefers pen and paper, we have a regular mail address to it. It's St. Paul Sunday at Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Thanks again, Gary. Good,
thank
beautiful
you,
show.
Great to,
again.
You. Great to be here.
And thanks for all of you folks who tuned in all the way from Handel to Chopin. Have a great week. Tune in next week. We'll be back here with St. Paul Sunday.
St. Paul Sunday is made possible by a major grant from the Minnesota-based General Mills Foundation, supporting excellence in education, human services, and the arts. Additional funding has been provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and by this Public Radio International station. St. Paul Sunday is produced by Minnesota Public Radio in the Maud Moon Weyerhaeuser Music Studio. Your host for the series is Bill McLaughlin. The senior producer is Mary Lee. The music producer is Steve Barnett. And the associate producer is Vaughn Ormseth. The engineer is Alan Strickland. And the production engineer is Michael DeMarc. The St. Paul Sunday website is produced by Nancy Blakestead. This is Marianne Sullivan.
You've been listening to the music of Franz Josef Haydn as performed by the Mendelssohn String Quartet, one of the selections on St. Paul Sunday's newest compact disc, Mixed Company. Visit our website at stpaulsunday.org to order your copy of Mixed Company, Music from St. Paul Sunday. This recording includes performances of Gil Shaham, the Emerson String Quartet, and many more, all recorded for this program and many not available elsewhere. And don't forget, your purchase of this recording helps support your station and St. Paul Sunday. Order your copy of Mixed Company from the St. Paul Sunday website, stpaulsunday.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.